For more information on Ancient Dragon Zen Gate, please visit our website at www.ancientdragon.org. Our teachings are offered to the community through the generosity of our supporters. To make a donation online, please visit our website.
So good morning, Bodhisattvas. Welcome, Josh and Morgan. I haven't seen you for a little while. It's nice to sit here with everyone this morning. This warm morning, we have kind of a cool little refuge here. I think this is the finale of Pride Month and weekend today. So I wish everyone well in that regard. I think maybe what I'd just like to do is hand things over to our board president, temple director, and temple priest, Paula, who also in another life is a kung fu master who runs a kung fu school. So very all-purpose practitioner, longtime practitioner at Ancient Dragon. Take it away.
Take it away. I mean, seriously, my stomach just turned like twice. Thank you for that very generous introduction. How gets it?
Did it turn because you were remembering all the work that you do?
No. You know, it's a good segue into this Dharma talk because I want to talk about one of the paramitas, which is ethical conduct. And my stomach just turned again. The more you're willing to put yourself out there, the more you're willing to take responsibility for leadership, for teaching, for community, the more pressure there is, really, for a person to act ethically. And there's more pressure as well for you to fail. So that's where that turning of the stomach came in. And, you know, we're in such a polarized time right now that there can be very little forgiveness for even saying the wrong thing, you know. But that is where we're living now, and we have to respond to that. And we have to be comfortable with that, and we have to negotiate that. So I wanted to talk about ethical conduct, bringing up my own dilemmas about it, my own practice around it, my own trying to negotiate and steer the ship through it. Because for everybody, it's very difficult right now, I think. And it's a little bit tricky. I think this is the one area of our practice that's a little bit tricky on what to do without becoming rigid or inflexible. The paramitas, if you're not familiar, are six qualities that it's suggested that someone who's on the bodhisattva path should develop. We chant the bodhisattva vows almost every time we get together, but it's a commitment to help to bring other beings to enlightenment or awakening, not because you know so much and not because they should wake up. And that's like, get woke, but so they could stop suffering. The impetus is compassion. As a bodhisattva, we want to help people so that they could stop suffering within the delusions of their perceptions of what's happening around them. So these qualities we develop as bodhisattvas are supposed to help us in that journey, in that path. So I'll tell, if you have forgotten, because, you know, there's so many lists in Buddhism, like I always have to write out the stuff too if I'm going to talk about it, because I might get one confused with the other. But the six paramitas or qualities that we're trying to develop as bodhisattvas are generosity, ethical conduct, patience, joyful effort, concentration, and wisdom. And often when I give Dharma talks, I talk a lot about the circular nature of our practice. And even though there are many lists in Buddhist practice that seem somewhat linear as they're presented, these aspects of practice actually work in a circular fashion. One kind of informs the other, informs the other, informs the other, and one might give rise of more dominance at a certain time than others, but they tend to work together. So, like, for example, if I want it to be linear, keeping in mind that these things don't work in a straight line, but generosity gives us an openness of heart and mind. It allows us to be more engaged with the world because there's a sense of a giving spirit. There's not a sense of that fear, right? Well, maybe I better keep things close to the vest. So generosity, then, if you're willing to engage more, then you have to have, and we know this as a society, you have to have a kind of format in which you engage with other people that has evolved over time. We agree there's a certain way to act with each other so that we don't cause harm to each other. Whether you're a Buddhist or not, our civilizations are based on that concept of experience and learning and agreeing upon what kind of works for all of us as a group so that we can survive as a group. Of course, if you're generous and you're trying to act in a way that is beneficial to everybody, it does take a lot of patience because nothing's going to happen like that. Whatever you think should happen won't happen right away. If you're truly interested in engaging with other people, there's a learning curve that has to happen so you can understand what motivates them and why they feel the way they do. So this takes a lot of patience. And then out of that patience, generosity and ethical conduct, joyful effort, then it's a little easier to be out in the world if we could engage with these qualities and we get confidence that these qualities are manifesting as we're engaging. It's not so distressful. It's not so frustrating. And it doesn't mean there aren't bad things going on in the world. But in each moment as we're engaging and responding, we could find joy in that moment. Why? Because we're completely alive. And whether we're suffering in pain in that moment or not, we're still completely alive in that moment. So there's a joy in that because we're realizing this gift of life. And then concentration and wisdom. And many of our Buddhist lists, these are always at the end. Concentration is our meditation practice. And out of our meditation practice, wisdom hopefully will arise. If we have faith in that practice, we don't have to really do anything besides practice. We don't have to coordinate the wisdom in any way. But being generous and having ethical conduct and being patient and having joyful effort will actually also help us settle deeper into our meditative practice. And the more all of those things are working symbiotically together, then hopefully the wisdom will manifest with the help of the Buddhas and ancestors, because we really don't have to do anything. We just need to get ourselves out of the way. That's really all we have to do. So if the Bodhisattva ideal is to realize unsurpassed, complete, and perfect awakening for the benefit of all beings, how does ethical conduct play into that? So now I want to look at this more specifically. And I'm kind of using as a jumping off point Reb Anderson's book. Reb Anderson is my Dharma grandpa. He is the one who gave Dharma transmission to Taigen. And he's one of the senior Dharma teachers in the lineage we're part of, the San Francisco Shunryu Suzuki lineage of Soto Zen. In his book, Entering the Mind of Buddha, Reb writes, Bodhisattvas vow to benefit and liberate all beings, and they renounce trying to control anyone, including themselves. Buddhas do not try to control unenlightened people into enlightenment. So I just love that sentence. Buddhas do not try to control unenlightened people into enlightenment. So in a sense, this kind of creates a dilemma for us. Anybody who practices any kind of spiritual path, doesn't have to be Buddhist, it could be anything. Usually, that theology, whatever you decide is good for you and you practice, has some kind of code of conduct that the community you're part of agrees you're trying to follow, and you're together helping each other try to follow that code of conduct. So for us, it's the 16 Bodhisattva precepts, three pure precepts, embracing and sustaining. This is translated different ways, but regulations and rituals. You could also say embracing right conduct or good conduct. But I put in parentheses how Reb explains it is doing no evil, embracing what is skillful, and purifying one's mind. And then also the second one is embracing and sustaining all good, and then embracing and sustaining all beings. The next three are the three refuges, taking refuge in Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. That's part of our 16 precepts. We're very familiar with that. And then we have the 10 major precepts. Now here's where the rubber hits the road, right? When you're out in the world, refrain from killing, refrain from stealing, do not misuse sexuality, refrain from lying, refrain from selling or encouraging the abuse of intoxicants, do not slander, refrain from praising self at the expense of others, refrain from being possessive, do not harbor ill will. That's a big one lately, right? Do not harbor ill will. And then don't disparage the triple treasure, which is the Buddha, Dharma, and Sangha. So we're using this framework of behavior as we move about the world. And whatever group you're part of, whatever religious group you're part of, there's a general agreement that this is kind of what we're all trying to do within the practice that we're engaging in. So we hope to manifest this code in the world because we as Buddhists now believe that it encourages enlightenment or a mind that is free from suffering. So here we are right back where we started again. So how do we affect change in society according to these precepts while at the same time not trying to control people? So that is our dilemma again. That is our dilemma because even though we say we don't want to control people, we do have an idea of how we should be living our lives. And that's why we're coming together in consensus. So when we step out into the world, we're kind of hoping other people feel somewhat the same way. But yet, we're not supposed to control them. We can influence them maybe, but is influencing them controlling them then? You know, so this is where the dilemma lies in our practice. How do we go about this? So I'm proposing, and then we could open this up for discussion as well. There could be a tendency to think of ethics and ethical conduct only as a means of looking outward. Ethics, by its definition, as we have already stated, concerns moral principles on what society views as proper conduct of people living together. So by its definition, we're looking outward. We're looking at the society that we're creating together as a group. But I am proposing that we practice ethical conduct not primarily by looking outward, but first and foremost by looking inward. So luckily, we had a very good example of this last week that Hogetsu was very nice to bring up. So, well, I'm going to remind you. I know, there's a lot, right? A lot flows through you because you get yourself out of the way. Hogetsu, like we know that. Not all the time. We're all human. We're all human. But if you get yourself out of the way, honestly, then you actually can't remember all the detail of what you said.
Right.
Because you're the vessel for the Buddhas and ancestors. You know what I'm saying? And I'll give you a little aside with this, too. I was joking with Dave Dirksen about this. During the Shuso questioning ceremony, and Jerry gave me that good advice, remember, you're not driving the bus. And I could tell you exactly, my ego got in the way just briefly. I felt it come in. And how it came in is I was like, okay, this seems to be going really well. How many people do I have left? And right when that happens, I'm like, no, get out of the way. Okay. I could tell you another story about martial arts when that happened to me, but I don't want to get off sidetrack. And it didn't end well at all because, you know, you could get hurt. So, I mean, really hurt, not like, oh, my feelings are hurt. <You know? laughs> But anyway, I digress, which is easy for me to do. So the best way to look inward is to look at our behavior towards people we disagree with, obviously, because therein lies the friction, there's the rub, there's the real challenge, right? So Hogetsu had brought up a book by Michael Wenger called 49 Fingers of Zen, where it gave little koan stories about modern Buddhist practitioners, and a lot of them were in our lineage, the Shunryu Suzuki lineage. So she brought up a story about Isan Tommy Dorsey, one of the Dharma senior Dharma leaders in our lineage who is no longer with us, about a situation where at one of the temples, I imagine when the public would come in and out, because, you know, just like here, even at the larger temples, the public could come in and out for certain events, a man would bring his horse in, because one of the temples is on a horse riding trail, you know, a man would come with his horse. He would get off the horse and he wouldn't tether the horse up. He would just let the horse graze, and the horse liked to graze in the flower garden. And that was the garden that they literally were cultivating flowers in. And there are a lot of roses also in that garden. So anybody who does gardening, of course I don't, it's too much work. But anyone who does gardening knows, I mean, there's a lot of time and effort that goes into it. Not only that, it's on the temple grounds. There's a lot of monastics who are living there who tend to this garden. And this man would just get off his horse and let his horse graze. I don't know why specifically the horse grazed in the rose garden. Now, even while Hogetsu is reading this story and me being, you know, all of these things that was listed, I was like, yeah, I would go up and say something to that guy. But I would try and be really nice. But maybe I would say, like, do you think it's a good idea? You know, something like that, right? So I'm like already thinking about what I would do. But I'm like, yeah, I definitely would go up and say something to him. But the way that Isan Dorsey went up to this man, he went up to him and he said, and this was amazing to me. He said, I'm going to say, excuse me, but I don't know if he said that because it wasn't in the story. But he said, it might not be a good idea for your horse to graze in the garden because it actually might get injured by the thorns that are on the rose bushes. And now I just get chills with that again. Now, speaking of ethical conduct, my mind went to the big thing. He's being rude to the temple, disrespectful. He's being disrespectful to the people who work in the garden. He's being completely oblivious of this little bit of upset that he's causing there and the kind of work that went into it. I was seeing the big problem, right? I was looking out. But Isan immediately looked inward. How could he respond to what he saw in front of him in a very intimate and personal way that abides by his 16 precepts? So not only was it a very personal response, but he also found common identity with this person right away by talking about the man's horse. So he met this person. Now Dogen calls this identity action. He met this person with a common point of view on something they could both be concerned about immediately. So they immediately connected to each other. He assumed the man must care for his horse, very much so, because he didn't tether it. He wanted it to be liberated and roam freely. So Isan communicated to the man in relation to this living being that from his perspective, this man deeply cared about. And he talked about the horse and the care of it. Now that to me is, and that's why I was saying, oh, it was perfect, that story, because I already was working on this a little bit and trying to come up with a practical example of how we could look inward. And then Hogetsu, by bringing that story forward, just, it was like being put on a table. Here you go. There's a perfect example. Now, this comes out of wisdom. Would I be able to do something like this? Like my thought process tells you, not right now. And maybe in a different situation. Maybe in a different situation I could. That wasn't about the horse eating the rose, or eating the flowers and so on and so forth. But I have confidence through my practice and through Zazen and through our rituals that this type of wisdom may also evolve for me. as I get my ego out of the way, so the Buddhas and ancestors could flow through manifesting Dharma. Isan concerned himself with how he himself was behaving towards this man, and really nothing further than that, even though it was a larger problem. So Dogen teaches that one of the embracing ideals of the Bodhisattva, or the four primary Bodhisattva practices, again, another list, is what he coined or is translated as identity action. So those four Bodhisattva ideals that Dogen talks about, Dogen being the founder of our Soto Zen lineage back in the mid-1200s. He brought this from China to Japan, for those who are not sure who he is. He taught the four Bodhisattva ideals of generosity, so this correlates to our paramitas, right speech, beneficial action, and identity action. So I'm referring now to this fourth one, identity action, how Isan found commonality by talking about the horse. Dogen says that identity action is non-difference, non-difference from self, non-difference from others. It's basically our eternal truth. Action means right form, dignity, and correct manner. So you connect at the universal, and then your action has the right form, right conduct, and right manner. And Dogen tells us by employing the proper response, by using identity action as a jumping off point, you cause yourself to be in identity with others. And then after causing others to be in identity with you. So the first thing you're doing is letting that person see the commonality you have with them. And by doing that, then you have commonality with them. I know it's the figure eight symbiotic, like chicken and egg story. What comes first? What really comes first? Dogen's saying nothing comes first, because we in universal truth, we're all connected anyway. We're actually all the same thing. Okay. So just simplistically for myself, when I try to negotiate these things, I try to keep in mind, if a person doesn't feel welcome, now we've been talking about this a lot too over here at Ancient Dragon Zenge, how to make people feel welcome. If a person doesn't feel welcome, immediately there is no connection at all. And that's just body language when you connect with someone right away. And then from that, if they don't feel respected, there's no connection then too. I think it's hard to make someone feel welcome if you don't respect them. So there has to be a common respect when we engage with everybody. So right there, that's just simple to keep in mind. Can I make someone feel welcome and respected in this moment, no matter what the engagement is? And it could literally, even if you were on a protest line and things were getting heated, and, you know, I'll use the classic example. You have a wall of policemen in front of you, and all of a sudden they become the other, and you're engaging directly with that policeman. How do you make him feel welcome to your presence and respected? And we know if we could do that in that one engagement, if he's grabbing you to pull you into a paddy wagon, I'm a child of the 60s, so this is where my mind goes right away. It could change everything right away. And you know his response will get elevated if he doesn't feel welcome or fought, and if he feels disrespected, especially for his job. And he might not even want to be there, actually. But that's his job. And why is it his job? Well, maybe he has family, maybe he has kids, maybe he has this, maybe that. Who knows? We don't know, because we don't know this guy, right? So that's what I mean. The specificity of what's actually in front of you, even though you might be out doing something in a larger context. And it's very hard to keep going back to that. But our practice tells us we have to go back to it again and again and again and again and again, each moment. Our Zazen tells us that each moment arises and we let it go, and the next one arises and we let it go. Every action potentially causes harm. And, you know, even in simplistically, we're all, you know, everyone's gone to school here in some fashion. We know farming causes harm, but if we didn't farm, we wouldn't have a civilization. We know building structures cause harm to the environment, but if we didn't build structures, we wouldn't be settled here in this temple. We wouldn't have it. We would still be itinerant practicing. We know medical procedures. It doesn't matter what it is, really. Any medical procedure causes some kind of harm. It's a percentage of, is it helping more than it's hurting? But anytime anyone intervenes in your physical body in any way, whether it be a drug, a knife, or whatever, it's causing your body harm. But maybe that's the only way you could get healed, right? And then, of course, the classic is disciplining children or even animals. You know, I'm watching The Dog Whisperer because it's streaming on Prime Video. And his big thing is, like, you got to be disciplined with the animals. They're not humans. They need discipline. When you offer discipline, they respond well to it. So it actually works out better for the animal. And discipline can work out better for the child, but it has to be done in a very ethical, proper way. But it's heartbreaking. And I'm saying that because there are times where I have to be harsh with children. And if they start crying in front of me, because that happens sometimes, it's heartbreaking to me. But you got to hold the line. Because in the long run, you're not doing them any favors. The younger they are, the more they're going to respond like that. But the younger they are, the better the discipline is at a younger age, because then it's easier for them to be disciplined then as they grow up. So you have to break your heart sometimes in the beginning for more benefit down the road. So these are all examples of realizing that when we look at ethical conduct, we have to realize no matter what we do in the world, we're still going to cause harm. Now, how do we deal with this? Now, I'm going back to Reb's words. What I found, and I could be wrong about this, Hoget, so you can tell me, but Reb is not afraid of using the words discipline when he teaches, and he's not afraid of using the words purify. And a lot of people have a bad reaction to that because of a lot of other disciplines they might have come into. Our society tends not to like those words. Maybe it's changing now, who knows, but purify in the Buddhist context, I like that word because we need to confess, repent, and atone. How do we as Buddhists do that? So that our ethical conduct is in line with the paramitas, with the precepts. How do we do that? Bodhisattva precept ceremony. Okay, now I'm bringing that up because we often don't understand why that is such an important ceremony. And that's why Hogetsu was very adamant on reasserting that ceremony for us here. Because this is how we as Buddhists, once a month we check in, we review how we were out in the world. We all make mistakes. It's acknowledging that we all make mistakes, but hopefully through the ritual practice, we are sincerely regretful with the mistakes that we're aware that we made, and we're making a vow. Now, I hate to say it because it's a goal, but we're making a vow to do better. Will we do better? We don't know, because we don't know what's going to happen next. But we do know that if we didn't do better, the Bodhisattva precept ceremony is going to be held again on the full moon. So it's within that ceremony that you're, and I like to say, like, massaging out frictional behavior, if you don't want to use the word purify. I like it because that's how I see it. You know, like you're kind of kneading dough, maybe until it disappears. But it's helping us even out those rough edges. I'll close with some more of Reb's words. The physical posture of being upright, we know that's our zazen posture, I hope, and then some. The physical posture of being upright helps to remind one of all the other ethical practices. It's about cultivating a deep understanding of how actions affect oneself and others. And once again, Buddhas are not intent on improving sentient beings whose original nature is pure. Okay, so I'm going to say that one more time. Buddhas are not intent on improving sentient beings whose original nature is pure. And then that's probably a good place to stop. And then I welcome your comments, questions, confusion, which I have plenty trying to figure out how to quantify and create a discrimination around these words, right? But I thank you all so much for listening, and I look forward to hearing your thoughts. Thank you. Thank you, everybody, so much. Jake.
Thank you for the talk.
Thank you.
I really appreciated your mention of how sometimes we have to hurt in order to grow or to accept discipline. And it reminded me of another writing by Reb Anderson, where he commented, and I'm paraphrasing here, in the lines of like, sometimes we do have to hurt to teach, but hurt is not necessarily harm. And that also resonated with me as a healthcare professional. So I appreciate you mentioning that aspect, because nobody wants to get an IV, but sometimes I got to throw one in so we can get you rehydrated because you're not looking so good. So.
Oh my God. And I imagine I sympathize with you in the sense that I imagine the shrieking sometimes you hear of people as these procedures can be done to them is heartbreaking, heartbreaking. And thank you so much for doing it, because I really respect all of you, because it's not something I could do. And compassion. I'm glad that you guys do it.
It's all done with compassion and to help reduce suffering.
And thank you so much.
We have David Ray online with his hand raised.
Hi, David. It's so nice to see you. You're still muted, I believe, David.
I muted it. Right, I'm back now. Thank you so much for your Dharma talk. There's so many things in it that I would like to, you know, say things about and ask things about. But like you, I have been thinking about Ihsan Dorsey and that story all week long. And there's a thing that I want to sort of raise up that I feel in it that is specifically queer. I think there's a lot of very specific, like, drag queen wit in that comment. It's sort of, I mean, you know, a lot of drag queens are very tough. And it's like if somebody, you know, like tries to punch a drag queen, they might say, "Oh, honey, I hope my chin didn't hurt your fist there." You know, it's sort of like he is sort of saying like, "Oh, honey, I hope those rose thorns don't hurt your horse." And there's a stinger there, because this is a practitioner. Like, at some point he's going to hear, "Oh, I was being completely thoughtless." I mean, there's a stinger in that comment, I think. I think it has a tail that will ultimately potentially discipline the person who hears it, but in a way that is like really specifically queer. Anyway, I loved your Dharma talk. Thank you.
Thank you, David. But I do agree, it could have been, but we didn't hear how he said it. Okay, so that's the thing. I got a weird flash on the screen right now, but I think you can hear me still fine, correct? Okay. Yeah, I think the tone of voice that it was said in, and my mind went there right away, though, too, because I'm notorious for that. Like, I'm notorious. Like, this is something I have to work on constantly, where I could say a nice thing, but I say it in a certain tone that people get confused. Like, they're like, "Wait a minute, she's saying something nice to me, but there's something that's kind of edgy in that tone." And so you can, and you see that, and you know, honestly, I'm human. I do all these kind of leadership power things. You know, you could take a little bit of joy in seeing that in the eyes. You know, that's the ego going, "Wow, look, aha, it's working." Now, here's the other side of that. It also works with children. Okay. And that's one of the reasons I came to practice, because I said something to a child once with that little bit of edge in it, and I saw the hurt in her eyes. Somebody that I knew from the age of 4 and a half, and at this point, she was 12. And I was like, "Man, I need to do something, because I got to check myself on this. Because I hurt her, and I did not want to hurt her like that. But I was so used to doing this as my way of life in the world, you know, with adults. But, you know, it's kind of a Chicago thing, too. So yeah, I came to practice, and I want to say though, I did. She's now 25, and I think when she was about 19, I told her about it because we were talking about my Zen practice, and I was like, "Honey, it's all because of you that I'm practicing Zen." And I told her that story again, and she goes, "Oh, they call me Sifu." And she goes, "Oh, Sifu, I don't even remember it." I go, "Of course, I didn't think you would. But in that moment, I saw the hurt in your eyes." And she goes, "Well, if I helped, I'm happy." So it all ended up okay. Thank you so much, David. Matthew.
So as you were just saying that, because that was something that I would hope I've improved on over the years of the barbed comment of maybe being less barbed, and I don't know how to formulate the question, but there's a paradox here with that line you ended on about beings that are. Whose fundamental nature is pure, and because we're those beings as well, and we're engaged deeply in a practice to change our being, and how do you sit with this catch-22 of how do we do the kneading and the softening while holding on to that broader perspective that we already are reflections of pure Buddha nature.
Mm-hmm. For me personally, you know, everybody has to have a reason to get out of bed. And none of us on the earth, doesn't matter what we don't really know why we're here. But the story I tell myself is that I am here specifically to uncover that purity in my nature. So I gave myself that as the reason I get out of bed. So any fault or fall or mistake I make or practice I engage in, that's why I'm doing it. Because of that. And again, I like to talk to all kinds of people. And I know people are atheists or agnostic. And of course, or they just don't believe anything, maybe science, or maybe they're cynical and they believe nothing. And they're going to say, yeah, that's a fiction you've told yourself. You know what I say? You're absolutely right. You're absolutely right. But I found I needed to tell myself a fiction because if I didn't, I didn't want to hang around anymore. So I needed some kind of fiction that I could tell myself to get myself out of bed every morning. That's how I deal with it. But that doesn't mean that everybody does. And I can't tell you, you guys know how grateful I am for this practice, because this practice fits, that fiction came up first that I tell myself, and this practice fits in perfectly with it. So, thank you. Leo.
Thank you so much for the talk. What I'm about to say, it's difficult to express, so bear with me.
Sure.
I have like a question and also a comment. The question is like, who is the you that shows up when you're disciplining or ethically treating someone? And how do you know? And the comment is, I have been like harsh and cruel at people, and the me that showed up was very hurt. And I was also like in the fantasy, like if I hurt someone, it would be some kind of like a revenge, mm-hmm. like a tit for tat, only to realize that it hurts more.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm thinking, sure, all of us could be Ishan, yeah? And for me, I have to remind myself that I can also be like that particular like person with the horse.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Thank you. Yeah, that is a very honest comment. Because wanting revenge, you know, that's a very human response to people hurting us. And I personally feel that all of us at some point come to realize what you've realized, that revenge and hateful ideas about people in the long run only hurt yourself. Some people come to that realization maybe when they're kids. I personally didn't. I really didn't until I was probably 35, maybe. How old are you? Yeah, there you go. Like around that time. Because you know how you spend the first part of your life, like you have ideas of what you want your life to be, and then things are supposed to fall into place, and then they don't. And so then when they don't, you start blaming other people. You know, we all go through this, right? And I think everyone goes through some kind of process like that until they realize that resentment, anger, that whatever it is, it could be an employer, it could be a lover, it could be a parent, it doesn't matter, or it could be all of those things. You're really hurting yourself because you get the rigidity, the constriction, your whole self gets smaller. So you've come to realize that yourself. Oftentimes people aren't honest that they're vengeful, hateful, and murderous. Okay, so oftentimes, and I think especially in spiritual communities, they like to say, oh, I can never do that. But people are people, and this is the identity action. You know, until you go deep enough, now we're talking about Joe Kobach and Darlene Cohen and all that, until you peel away enough of those onion layers, you don't realize that, and this is me from my practice, it's there. And when you find it's there, then you could truly connect with everybody around you. Because it's there for them too. So that's just a comment on your comment. But for trying to decide what to do in the moment, I could give you very practical answers. Depending on if you're in a practice, you do what you've seen your seniors do. You try to remember their example and imitate it, you know, until you feel you are somewhat successful in that. And then over time, as your practice deepens and the wide expanse starts to happen, you know, where you have a wide field when you sit in meditation and you have faith in that wide field will be with you more often in the world. And when you're engaging completely, completely present, completely attentive to the person in front of you, intuition comes up inside of you and it tells you what to do. It's literally a voice inside of you that tells you what to do. Even if it's hard, because he knows doing medicine, you know, and you've been doing it a while. So, you know, a lot of it's instinct for you. And especially what you have to do with the patient to get them to comply. You know, maybe he has to strap someone down. Maybe he could just talk nicely to them. But it's going to come in. And that's the Buddhas and ancestors. That's where you see you're not alone. You're not alone. If you could create that wide open space, you're not alone. They're going to tell you what to do. You just have to trust the intuition that you're feeling in that moment, and then you have to see it through. And then you deal with the next moment and the next moment. Get rid of the goal, the result that you're trying to get. You have to keep getting rid of it and just do the next thing. So that's my practical answer on that. But in the beginning, just act as if, remember what people around you do. Thank you.
We have Patrick Harrington with his hand raised online.
Hi, Patrick.
Hello. I was just digesting what you said about what brought you to practice, and you potentially, you know, hurting somebody by your action, causing them suffering, and thinking to myself that the suffering that you might have caused them temporarily caused you a lot more suffering overall. Mm-hmm.
Right.
And I just realized that probably majority of my suffering is suffering that I caused other people indirectly as well. And thank you for that. That really helps out a lot.
Thank you, Patrick. And then that also speaks to, Leo, what you were saying. Well, I believe it's probably close to wrap-up time. it is wrap-up time. That's the definitive wrap-up time. So we will chant the four Bodhisattva vows. Beings are numberless, we vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, we vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless, we vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, we vow to realize it. Beings are numberless,
we vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, we vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless, we vow to measure them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable, we vow to realize it. Beings are numberless, we vow to free them. Delusions are inexhaustible, we vow to cut through them. Dharma gates are boundless, we vow to enter them. Buddha's way is unsurpassable,